Hello, fellow law nerds. Welcome to another episode of Boom Lawyered, a Rewire Radio podcast hosted by the legal journalism team that is joining the war on Christmas by wishing everyone a happy holidays, and that's it. I'm Imani Gandhi.
And I'm Jess Piclo.
Happy holidays, and that's it.
Rewire.news is dedicated to bringing you the best reproductive rights and social justice news, commentary, and analysis on the web. And the Team Legal Podcast is part of that mission. Support for Rewire and Boom Lawyered is provided by
you. Seriously, you. Small dollar donations power our reporting, our commentary, our investigations, and you guessed it, this podcast, which is your favorite podcast. You can admit it to us. We won't tell anybody. You can make a donation to Rewire by going to rewire.news/December right now.
Do it. Rewire.news/December.
Happy holidays.
So this episode, we're going to talk about The Handmaid's Tale come to life. Marching Toward Gilead is a Rewire radio documentary about the radical Christian activist group Operation Save America. And these folks are terrible.
They are terrible.
So bad. They've got this dystopian worldview that includes recriminalizing abortion, basically ignoring any law they don't agree with, and even a rising political influence with Trump. Plus their name, it's the stuff of nightmares.
Their name is about as annoying as, quote unquote, make America great again. Operation Save America. Save America from what?
From ourselves, apparently. And I'm guessing they're joining forces with Concerned Women for America.
And the Susan B. Anthony list and Democrats for Life. Oh, my God. Get out of my uterus, people.
Democrats for Death, really. Like, what? Seriously, what are people doing with these names?
At any rate, we are psyched to have our amazing colleagues and the force behind the documentary, Jen Stanley and Sophia Resnick, here to talk with us about their work. But before we do, Jess and I are going to give you a background on the laws intended to protect abortion clinics and patients and the arguments that these radical activists are making to challenge that access, and in some cases, trying to get away with murder, like literal actual murder.
For real murder.
Straight up murder.
All right, so let's start with the federal law. What is the FACE Act?
Is it an act that requires people to stay the hell out of my face?
Pretty much.
Yes.
So it is. I mean, you're sincerely not that far off. The Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances, or FACE Act, was signed into law in 94 by President Bill Clinton, and it essentially requires people to stay the hell out of the faces of folks trying to access reproductive health care and facilities. So like I said, Imani, you are not too far off at all.
So what does it do exactly?
Specifically, FACE makes it a federal offense to do a couple different types of things, like use force or threats of force or to physically block access to reproductive health care facilities. So that includes things like gluing clinic locks shut, which activists have done, forming human chains in front of clinics, which activists have done, stealing and posting patient records online, which activists have done, to even mailing letters telling doctors that they might find a bomb under their car if they keep providing abortions, which...
Wait. Let me guess. Activists have done that too.
Can you believe it?
I'm shocked. Basically anything that could intimidate patients, providers, and their companions out of getting to a clinic.
Yep, it covers all of that. So who can bring a FACE Act claim? A state attorney general or the Department of Justice. They can bring either civil or criminal claims or both. Now, individuals like patients or providers or escorts, they can bring their own civil lawsuits. So in other words, FACE has both criminal and civil penalties. Only the state can bring criminal charges and individuals can bring lawsuits in their own name as well.
So what are the difference between the criminal and the civil penalties?
A civil claim is one for money damages, and criminal penalties include things usually like jail times and sometimes some kind of money penalty too, but it really focuses on, you know, locking folks up and things like that. And in theory, this should give people two different avenues to protect their rights under the FACE Act, but that doesn't always happen.
So it's good to point out that there's actually fair criticism of the FACE Act, even though it's a very important and useful law. For one thing, the penalties are not severe enough, and it's a remedial statute. And the remedial statute, that's a play on the word remedy, that means that the bad thing already has to happen before the law can step in and remedy that bad thing.
Totally. So when you're thinking about threats, for example, like, you know, one of the issues that will come up is, well, when is it actually a threat? And when is it just, you know, free speech? And we see anti-choice activists making this claim all the time. And providers and patients have said, well, you know, we're scared early on, but the law has said, well, you know, too bad you're scared. That's not actually, you know, something hasn't really happened for us to step into it. So that's a big criticism of it. You know, and FACE is also supposed to work together with local protest ordinance, like the kind we saw in play in Rewire's award-winning documentary, Care and Chaos. But like that film also showed, the law is only as good as it's enforced. And, you know, here's some shocking news for you. The Bush administration sucked at enforcing FACE Act. The Obama administration got better. The Trump administration with Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is probably going to be a total trash fire. And I mean, who knows how local law enforcement is going to act in any given place at any given time. So then why do we need FACE?
Because these people are fucking terrorists.
Hey, Imani, can you give us a brief rundown of some of the history that got us the FACE Act to begin with?
It would be my distinct pleasure. So, in March 1993, Michael Griffin murdered Dr. David Gunn in Pensacola, Florida, specifically because Gunn provided abortions. Griffin waited outside the clinic and shot Gunn in the back three times, and he reportedly shouted, quote, "We need more babies." He then waited for the ambulance so he could make sure that he was caught.
I'll give it to these folks. At least Griffin was right out there in the open about his motivations, right? More babies, and waited around to get caught. So, you know, he wasn't being shy about it. He wanted folks to know.
He had the courage of his convictions. I guess we can say that for him. His attorney argued that John Burt, who's the regional director of Rescue America, had brainwashed his client. Burt was a former KKK member, lovely, and he was later convicted of sexually abusing teenagers at a shelter that he founded for unwed mothers. So if you could imagine a more shitty person that would actually found a shelter for unwed mothers and then sexually abuse their kids?
Wait, but that sounds kind of familiar. Like maybe Roy Moore?
Sure does. Roy Moore has definitely been alleged to be a creeper, and he was banned from a mall in the 80s, which is very difficult to do if you have any idea the sort of shenanigans that were going on at malls in the 80s. But seriously, we're children of the 80s, Jessica. You know I'm right.
Seriously, malls were like, the source of all potential trouble.
Yeah, really. So back to Griffin. Griffin, his conviction of first-degree murder and his life sentence was a mobilizing call for these anti-abortion extremists. One movement leader, Paul Jennings Hill is his name, would end up issuing a statement signed by over 20 other movement leaders that embraced justifiable homicide of doctors who perform abortion. Now, what the fuck is justifiable homicide, you may be asking? Well, we're going to get to that in a second. But first, Jess is going to tell you a little bit more about Paul Hill.
Yeah, Paul Hill, this guy's great. So he's also a convicted murderer. In 1994, he murdered Dr. John Britton and Britton's bodyguard outside his clinic in Pensacola, Florida. As you can imagine, Pensacola, Florida during this time is a hotbed of radical anti-abortion extremism. Hill was sentenced to death by lethal injection and eventually executed in 2003. During his trial, he represented himself and also tried to argue justifiable homicide, and the court wouldn't let him, though. That doesn't mean the idea didn't pick up steam with other anti-abortion activists.
Like Scott Roeder, for example. In 1999, Scott Roeder murdered Dr. George Tiller at Tiller's Church in Wichita, Kansas. Like the others, he wanted to get caught, and like the others, he also tried to argue justifiable homicide. And like the others, the courts refused to let him. Roeder is still in prison serving a life sentence.
Thankfully. Then also we have most recently Robert Louis Deer. So he's the guy responsible for the November 2015 Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood shooting. That's the one that left three folks dead and nine others wounded. He's facing 179 felony counts related to the siege, but so far no FACE Act claim. Now, why that's the case, I don't know. Maybe or likely because the prosecutors think a conviction and the penalties are stronger against Deer under state law. We don't know, in part because he's currently being held in a Colorado mental health facility because the court doesn't think he's competent to stand trial because he said such things as, no more baby parts when he went in shooting, which is weird given, you know, the others. But, you know, I guess that's probably a different episode. Deer has made it clear, though, that if he gets the chance to stand trial, he intends to argue that his actions were justified under the law. So with that kind of setup, what actually is justifiable homicide? We're going to get to that next. So Imani, can you explain this idea of justifiable homicide for us? Because it sounds kind of bananas.
Sure. So it's a defense theory in criminal cases that says, basically, your crime, in this case murder, is excusable under the law because it was done for the better good. In this case, saving babies, as is the refrain from these folks. It works in part with another terrifying idea that these folks are pushing, and that is the idea of quote-unquote lesser magistrate. Now, lesser magistrate says that any government official, including law enforcement, doesn't have to enforce laws that they have a moral objection to, like, for example, the FACE Act.
Right. So effectively, what we have argued from the far right here is that they can choose the laws they like and choose the laws they don't like, and nobody can do a damn thing about it. And now all these jerks feel emboldened with the Trump win and Sessions as attorney general. And we're seeing that play out in very real and very terrifying ways right now.
In late July, Operation Save America launched an intentional challenge to the FACE Act by reinstituting the rescue missions that helped lead up to the law's passage in the first place. The group descended on the last remaining clinic in Kentucky for a week of protests, very similar to the 1993 Summer of Mercy protests in Wichita, Kansas, with a single goal. They wanted to close the clinic in Kentucky.
And they weren't going to stop in Kentucky either. Most recently, they've even descended on the clinic in North Carolina that's featured in Care and Chaos by the thousands. And the singular goal is to cause chaos, to get arrested, and to scare people from coming into the clinics.
Our colleagues, Jen and Sophia, will tell us about these protests and the scary-as-shit world that Operation Save America folks want to usher in for all of us.
In Marching Toward Gilead, Jen and Sophia take a deep dive into the group Operation Save America. Now, this is a group with some of its members that were once viewed as so extreme, the FBI investigated them for a violent conspiracy related to their anti-abortion activism. Jen and Sophia are going to take us through how, in the age of Trump, this group has entered into the political mainstream, which is terrifying. Jen and Sophia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Okay, so how did this happen? Can you tell us what the inspiration was for this documentary?
I was first planning to go down to Louisville in the summer for the Operation Save America's national event. They hold it every year in a different city. And about 2 months before this event, Operation Save America blockaded the clinic, EMW Women's Surgical Center. It's the last clinic in Kentucky. And it seemed like they might be challenging the FACE Act and returning to old tactics. So I reached out to Sophia, who is an investigative reporter, and she'd been covering the Department of Justice a lot. And I wanted to know what her take on this was. She had been covering the religious right for a long time. And we just decided that this might be a bigger story than we thought. And we teamed up, and that's kind of how it all began.
That actually goes perfectly into my question for both of you, which is, you know, you've both been covering anti-choice activists and the politics around their movement for a while now. And Sophia, I guess I'll start with you. Why do you think we're seeing a resurgence of the rescue mission, particularly now?
Well, I think there's this general feeling among many in the anti-abortion movement that not enough change in their favor has been made. You know, they've been working for the last 40 plus years to overturn Roe v. Wade and make abortion illegal. And it just hasn't happened. Although, you know, they certainly have gained a lot of victories in their camp, very much restricting abortion and limiting abortion access throughout the country. But they won't be satisfied until it is a crime. So I think that there is this sense of urgency among a lot of people that, you know, more needs to be done. We can't just focus on incremental changes in the legislature and, you know, waiting for the Supreme Court to make, you know, decisions here and there. We just need to take action. We just need to, let's start stepping in front of this, these abortion clinics, and just let's not let people walk in.
So ideas like quote-unquote lesser magistrate, which is this notion that essentially you can ignore the law if God tells you to, those ideas seem really out there, but they're not anymore, are they?
I mean, when we talk about lesser magistrate, I think we sort of have to step back a little and say that it's not just a religious concept, right? Like, for example, sanctuary cities is an example of this idea of interposition or this idea of lesser magistrates intervening in what they think is immoral or unjust, right? But in the case of the Christian right, and specifically people like members of Operation Save America, they think that there is only one moral authority, and they think that they are the only ones who know what the, you know, what the correct interpretation of the Bible is, and that man's law has to be applied thusly. And so, for example, with same-sex marriage, they think that, you know, it's time. God is calling county clerks like Kim Davis and former state Supreme Court chief justices like Roy Moore to intervene in this immoral law. And by intervening, they mean by, you know, violating the federal law saying that same-sex marriage is legal and denying people the right to marry.
Jen, I'm wondering if you can share some thoughts, particularly since you have a lot of experience covering this area too, on what it means. What's the significance of having someone like Roy Moore run and, you know, at least as of this recording, maybe even be a U.S. senator?
Yeah. You know, Roy Moore wasn't even really on my radar when we started doing this story. The Roy Moore thing really like threw a wrench in our story because we couldn't not comment on it, especially given his very close ties to Operation Rescue, Operation Save America. You know, when we started thinking there was more going on here than just, you know, the effort to close down the clinic in Kentucky, we were looking into lawmakers that Operation Save America was meeting with, and you'd be surprised by how many there have been. We were surprised, you know, we were surprised by the level of people, we were surprised by the people at the state level who, you know, were taking meetings with Operation Save America, aligning with Operation Save America, drafting legislation with Operation Save America. Roy Moore, regardless of if he won or not, the fact that he was running as such a major candidate, I think is just evidence of all of the concerns that we bring up in this piece.
Yeah, I mean, I think what surprised me about the whole Roy Moore thing is that, yeah, it was just crazy that to think that if Operation Save America had wanted to craft their ideal candidate to get up to the U.S. Senate. Like, I don't think they could have created a better one than Roy Moore. But then the fact that, you know, then he's accused of these very significant sexual assault allegations, again, sexual assault and sexual misconduct against minors. You know, and not only that, but in this climate where like we're finally, you know, caring about sexual harassment and sexual assault and all of these very popular politicians and artists and actors are losing their jobs. Like the fact that he, if he doesn't win, it will be by the very skin of his teeth. Like that is just kind of mind blowing to me.
I don't know as a reporter for sure if these members that I spoke to who continue to support Roy Moore after the sexual assault allegations came out, if the reason is that they don't believe the women or that maybe they don't even think it's that big of a deal, given the importance of male headship in the evangelical movement. We had Flip Benham say at a press Flip Benham, who used to be the leader of Operation Save America, at the press conference in support of Roy Moore said, you know, if you dug up my past, like, oh, I'd be in a lot of trouble. And then kind of doubled down on those statements later in a radio interview in which he's saying that, you know, Roy Moore had to go after younger women because he was coming back from Vietnam and, you know, all the other women were taken, you know, or having sex and he needed a pure bride. And so, you know, the younger women were the only options. Yeah. So I do think that it also shows just like some kind of this acceptance of like these really, really scary like views of male headship and to put that on a national level right now, just as women are getting more momentum and getting more seats in Congress, is really frightening.
So Jen and Sophia, in terms of what you would like the audience for Marching Toward Gilead to take out of your documentary, are there a nugget or two that you think are really of things that are really significant or really important to you as storytellers that you want to make sure the audience hones in on?
Yeah, this is Jen. I think it is easy to dismiss the actions of groups like Operation Save America and other kind of more, now I feel like I'm backing off of the word extreme, but, you know, more in your face, anti-choice activism, the fundamentalist Christian activism. But the fact that, like, I genuinely found a path to power for these people doing this reporting. Like, I found things that surprised me. You know, it was a bigger story than I thought it was going to be. And I think that people really need to be aware. And I think one of the things maybe people are missing too is, you know, we forget about our state government. We forget about state elections. We forget about the state legislature. That's where a lot of people with the most far right views are. And they're passing the laws that are affecting people's lives in those states. They're passing the laws that affect people day to day. I hope that people come away with this realizing, like, oh, like, we really need to pay attention and really take it seriously that that there is a path to power and that we can't just keep writing this off as extremism, that maybe to some extent, like, writing all of these things off as just extremism is part of how they were able to advance, you know, without people noticing.
So I just want to emphasize that this is not just a story about, you know, a quote unquote extreme fringe organization. And here are the extreme things that they're saying. You know, these are people too, right? Like, we try to get at who they are. We try to show really human moments. They're warm and nice to us and funny at times, but they're very open about who they are. And we are just trying to show the world that hasn't really been paying attention why what they're saying could be concerning.
When I go down the rabbit hole of thinking about what their world looks like, after talking to them, after the literal things that they've said to me, it just sounds exactly like Gilead from The Handmaid's Tale, like exactly like it. And it's frightening.
When you guys talked about the strategy, it made me think of the discussion that Imani and I had a few episodes back about Ohio and their 20-week ban versus their 6-week ban, and how, you know, Imani really broke it down, but how the politicians played off of one another so that the 6-week ban seemed really extreme when then Kasich signed the 20-week ban because, oh, this is a much more reasonable restriction on abortion rights, not like that, you know, 6-week ban, which is clearly bananas. And I'm wondering if you guys have any thoughts if that's happening now with, you know, the Operation Save America folks being given much more leeway and, you know, what would normally be considered sort of mainstream, you know, Republican lawmakers or candidates kind of caping for them.
I would say that, you know, the analogy I would say, like, the 20-week ban to the 6-week ban is like Operation Save America's, like, focus on abortion rights when what they really want is a totalitarian theocracy. You know, like, we spoke to somebody who used to be a member of Operation Rescue when she was a child, and she's since left the movement. Her name is Catherine Brightbill. She's featured a lot in the story. But she talks about how when she, by the time she was in college and she went to an evangelical college, like, what she was learning at the evangelical college was that, you know, what they really wanted was something much bigger than that. And that abortion rights was just one, like, chipping away at abortion rights was kind of like one way to do it, almost a distraction, because it's not the end goal of what they want at all. And so it's almost like maybe people can swallow, like, if they don't know how they feel about abortion, they can kind of be on board with this, with, you know, limiting abortion access, but they're not really thinking about the fact that this is, like, actually just taking all rights away from women and making them respond to, like, this male figure in their life, this male authoritarian figure in their life, whether that be their husband or every person in government who they believe should be male. So I don't know. Does that make sense?
Sure. So it's kind of like, you know, in The Wizard of Oz, don't look behind the curtain, right? Like, here's a, you know, here's a show going on. And then, oh, behind the works is actually this larger thing.
Exactly.
That's interesting that you say that, because that's something that I've heard from people like Pamela Merritt with respect to abortion politics in Missouri, how, you know, over the past couple of years, there's been this sustained effort to clamp down on abortion access. But a lot of times these bills get introduced but never pass. And she said that's because they like to just sort of maintain this sort of base level of outrage when it comes to abortion. Meanwhile, they're doing all of this other horrible stuff in the background. So that's interesting.
Thank you both so much for joining us. Can you tell us where folks can find Marching Toward Gilead?
Yes. You can find Marching Toward Gilead at rewire.news/Gilead. And we're so excited for you to hear it.
Listen to it, everyone. Seriously.
Please do.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
That's it for us, y'all. We'd like to wish you a very happy holidays and let you know that we will see you in January. But while you're on vacation or on break with your family opening presents, why not take the time to listen to our first 7 episodes?
They pair nicely with eggnog and booze.
They really, really do. That's it for us. Thanks very much for listening and have a happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Boom Lawyered is created and hosted by Imani Gandhi and Jessica Mason Piglow. The show is produced by Nora Hurley. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. And Rewire's editor-in-chief is Jody Jacobson.